So today we got Chandler Bolt. What's up, man?
What's going on?
Chandler's the founder and CEO of selfpublishing.com. He has helped publish 7,000 plus books. They publish between 2 and 5 books a day. That is ridiculous. Their company's done like $70 million in revenue from just publishing people's books. So welcome, man.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, I mean, I have published books. I've published these two tiny little books. Look how small those are.
I love it.
Are these smaller than any books you've published?
Probably. There was my first book that I got my first 1-star review, and the ladies, and it was a short book on productivity, right? Uh-huh. We figured if you're reading a productivity book, you probably don't have a ton of time to read a book, so let's keep it short. And my first 1-star review, they said, too bad it's not big enough to even use for something useful like a doorstop.
Oh. I think everyone gets some of those reviews, though, just describe.
It was probably about that size.
I've got a lot of 1-star reviews of like, this is so short, I could have just read a blog post. I got a lot of that. But then I got a lot of 5-star reviews. So I'm just like, I mean, so long as it's 4 and over, I'm happy with it. Wait, so okay. So 7,000 books you've helped pub, is that right? Is that the number?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, it's probably more than that at this point. It's kind of hard to track, but we published.
Cause that's a funny thing to say.
It was happening all the time, and we self-publish, right? So we put the power back in the hands of the authors. So we don't have kind of the gatekeeping mechanism of the publishing. We do a lot of publishing now for them, but it makes it kind of tricky to track. But it's funny you mentioned about, just quick sidebar, I love this concept of, it's the Perry Marshall concept of the 3-star review book with no 3-star reviews. And it's because the message in 80-20 sales and marketing is be polarizing. And I think you're great at that. You're one of the best at that. And I think those books are a great example of it, where I'm assuming you got way more 5-stars than you do 1-stars. But his whole thing is, if you write on a polarizing topic, it's a 3-star review book with no 3 stars, because it's the 5 stars and the 1 stars, and they're all arguing, trying to convince each other.
Well, here was my theory. I was just like, there's a lot of concepts that I could explain much quicker. So it used to be YouTube videos were like an hour long training. Now there's like a 60-second short that you learn something from. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, the shortification of content has been going on for a while. And I was like, why not a book? Because when I was writing this book, it was like a couple of like small chapters, and I was like, I think I'm done.
Yeah.
And there was actually Naval Ravikant's brother, Kamal Ravikant. Mm-hmm. And he had this tiny little 45-page book. And I asked him all about it and modeled this after that. And it ended up being like a 45-page book. And I bought his book and liked it. And I was just like, yeah, I got the concept I needed. I paid $5 bucks for it. I feel that was a fair trade in value. Mm-hmm. He gave me probably more than $5 of value. Mm-hmm. And I took about 30 minutes of time to read it. All's good. And so I wanted to write a book like that. I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, it reminds me of the concept that I learned from you, I think, way back in the copywriting course, which I think I've told you before, was one of the first courses that I ever bought on the internet.
Nice.
And I remember you talked about writing good copy, and people always ask, how long should the copy be? Kind of like, how long should the book be? And you said, like a woman's skirt. You said, long enough to cover the essentials, but short enough to keep it interesting.
Wow. I've had to since remove that. By the way, I didn't even say that. It was actually a Joe Sugarman quote. He said it back in the 70s, when you could probably say something like that. Surprised you remember that quote so well.
Yeah, I mean, I was a young adolescent boy, and you used a female skirt analogy, so that kind of stuck.
It was a good analogy. I've never been able to
really
like,
is though
recreate it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, what's the corollary for that? I wonder.
I don't know,
because people ask me, "Hey, how long should the book be?" And I want to use that example, but it's not really on brand. Hey,
here's the lamer example than the woman's skirt analogy. It's just like it could be long, but it can't be long winded.
Hmm. And okay.
So, yeah, not long-winded. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of books. I'm not saying Ryan Holiday's books are like this. I'm just saying there's one, and I'll tell you the kicker later. There was one where I read the first page, his first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying. Page 1 through 120 were banger. And I was like, dude, this is one of the best books I've ever read. And then the next 120 pages, I remember like it fell off a cliff. And then he's actually one of my buddies. And I asked him about it. He's like, oh yeah, the publisher wanted me to add more stories in to make it thicker so they could sell it for more money. Okay. And I was like, oh, so the A material was what he wrote. And the publisher was like, you just have to make the book fat for no other purpose than to make it a thick book.
So
and I remember thinking about that, because I've read so many books where I'm just like, oh, the book kind of fell off after a while. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the author's like, I got to write more stuff. And so they just end up writing like some long-winded stories and stuff just to fill the book. So tell me, okay, 7,000 books. You are in a unique position to answer this question. It's like, what is the hardest part of writing a book for people? What is the hump that they can't get over? I'm currently writing another book, and it's been 2 years to write a 45-page book. Like, what? Mm. How stupid am I? Why is it taking so long? Like, what is the hard part? Like, why can't people ever get that book out?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because, you know, we've published 7,000 books, but there's also a bunch of other, probably thousands of other authors we work with that haven't published yet, right? And so you kind of get to see that, and we've seen it in the actual data. There's two big humps. There is I always say the hardest part is getting your first rough draft done, and that is the demarcation point where people either they get it done and then they see the light at the end of the tunnel, it happens. We see that in the data. But I think really the biggest hump for most people is starting. So there's committing to it and starting, which is, okay, obviously if you don't do that, you can't get here. But then right after that, there's this, you get excited. It's kind of like you've probably heard of I love the concept of the shelf esteem, right? You buy something, you feel good, you put it on your shelf esteem, your bookshelf, you feel good about yourself, and then it just stays there.
Wait, so people actually come to you not having like a book idea? Or not even, they just want to write a book and then they don't have anything?
They don't have an idea, they'll have a decent idea, or they got too many ideas, and then we help them distill, right? Mm. But then they buy or decide to work with us, and then there's this dopamine hit, and then sometimes people just fall off, where it's, okay, I feel like I achieved the thing when I bought it. It's a weird, I'm sure you know this from copywriting, this kind of consumer psychology is like the best time to upsell someone is right after they buy.
Yeah.
Because they're in that mode of chasing that dopamine. So, but then there's an equal amount where we always say our biggest competitors are not actually other companies. It's someone not doing the book, or it's doing them thinking that they can do it themselves. Those are our two biggest competitors.
It is weird because I've published thousands of blog posts, but only two books. And to me, that book is just a long blog post. Mm-hmm. In fact, actually, both of those books were blog posts first. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of like fleshed them out into a book form. One thing I noticed, because I have a lot of friends that have published traditional media, like going with Penguin, Random House, one of those big ones, versus just self-publishing on Amazon. The benefit to Amazon, I noticed, was that you could just put the book out. And if there's mistakes, people report them. And you can just go in Amazon and correct them. I think it auto-corrects it for you half the time. Like you miss a comma or something. You'll be like, there's supposed to be a comma here. And you click approve and it just doesn't. Whereas Penguin, Random House, whatever, like it's one and done. So I had like my buddy Noah Kagan took like 4 years to write his book because they're going through it. Because once you publish it, you ain't touching it.
That's right.
Whereas on Amazon, you can just like update the book continuously. It's like a living thing more than anything, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the cool thing. And it's a huge difference between traditional publishing and self-publishing is you have the actual control of all the things. So you can, this is an updated and revised version. I did it. I can do that, right? Because I can change it at any point. You can change the cover, you can change the subtitle, you can change the content.
And like the next book that gets sold will be made like that.
Exactly.
Because it's just like a machine that prints them out each time.
So that's a big one. But then you also have access to all the things. Like I'll never forget, I think it was maybe Nathan Latka after he published his book and he's asking me to do the breakdown on all the stuff on how he sells more stuff. I'm like, well, first thing, let's get some Amazon ads rolling, get in the account. And he's like, oh, well, I don't have access to the account. And so then he's just pestering his publishers who were totally clueless, or his publisher who's totally clueless. Hey, can you please log into my account and start running ads? I will pay for it. And they wouldn't. And so just like little things like that, that you would never think of the actual ability that gets unlocked when you can log into the Amazon profile and run ads, like all the stuff.
You were early to the self-publishing game. And so I don't know if you know this, back when AppSumo days, me and Noah were going to write a book together when AppSumo was taken off. And we sold a course called the Sumo Business Blueprint. It sold like 10,000 plus copies for way more than a book costs. And we approached book publishers. I think it was Tim Ferriss's or Ramit Sethi's book publisher. I forget. We met him in New York. And if you could sell 10,000 books, they don't care. Whatever. I think they're just like, let's just get this thing out the door. So I was going to write most of it. And they wanted kind of this like 7-step process to make a business. And we were like, like anything remotely of like what we would try. And went this whole process. And then you know who decided to get us out of it? Tucker Max.
Oh, really?
Of all people. Mm-hmm. And I know he started Scribe and some competing company. And then there was some drama. I have no idea what happened with that, but it was a big deal.
Yeah.
But he actually told us, he's just like, the book publishing company isn't going to do anything for you.
Mm-mm.
And I was like, what do you mean? Like paying them all this money? Like what is, they're certainly going to help you with like this and this editing and blah, blah. He's like, no, they're not gonna do anything. What do they do? I'm really genuinely kind of curious. Like what, there must be something good they do.
Publishers pretty much do nothing. I mean, they,
so I know you're going to be biased, but
sure.
But at the same time, I really tried to think of like, what does the publisher do? Besides hound you about stuff.
It's basically nothing. I mean, yes, I am biased running sellpublishing.com, but I think we can help people either way. Now, the thing we can't help them with is if they don't have access to their account. So there's this whole bucket of things that are off the menu that we can do or anyone who self-publishes can do that a published author through a traditionally published company just cannot do. And so you kind of lose that there's these off-menu items. But beyond that, it used to be that the only way that you sold books was to get into bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to get into bookstores was to have a publishing deal. The only way to have a publishing deal was to have an agent and, right? And that was the distribution. But now, it's a crazy stat, 80% of all books sold are sold on Amazon and other online retailers, and you don't need a publisher. So it's democratized distribution for authors. It's actually very similar to, you know, my brother's in the music industry, plays in a pretty big rock and roll band, has done that for decades.
Mm-hmm.
The music industry, the publishing industry, and the movie industry are almost identical.
Uh-huh.
You can just swap the names of, you know, Netflix is to Spotify is to Amazon in some ways, right? And you can spot whether it's a publisher or a record label or a movie house or whatever. It's very similar. And that's why a lot of people are self-publishing now, is because distribution was the main thing. And so now they don't do that. Really, they will help you have a more quality book. Maybe if you don't know what you're doing, that's mm-hmm. they can kind of guide you through the process. They can maybe unlock a couple stores that you could typically otherwise get if you self-publish. And then maybe they'll try and get you on the Today Show or something. Probably will not. They don't really do much. But either way, like whether you traditionally publish or self-publish, you've got to be the captain of the ship for the marketing of the book. Otherwise, it's not going to do well.
Yeah, I've seen people go with regular publishers that probably definitely should have just self-published.
Yes.
And it took years of time. The publishing company did essentially nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally nothing. I was just like, what is
except
the point?
Keep all the royalties.
They're like, oh, you got to like design your book covers and we'll like review it. And you're like, you didn't even do the book cover? That Mm-mm. seems like the easiest part of it.
Totally.
And so I think there's a couple, like Noah Kagan, good example of someone who went through a publisher because he wanted to get New York Times bestseller, but also has like a big media team already, was also
right.
pushing hard for this goal, has the financial resources to do it, also had a big company already.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone like that, okay, publisher to get on New York Times bestseller,
mm-hmm.
literally the only totally. Reason
yeah.
to get there. For the average person just putting out kind of like a life bio or, you know, talking mm-hmm. about something that they did in the SaaS world or something like that, it doesn't seem like a publisher is necessary at all.
No, it's not. And you hit on the one caveat that I give is if you've got a massive audience and you can get a huge advance, maybe it makes sense.
Mm.
Now, there's plenty of people that, you know, like Hal Elrod, who did so well with America Morning, self-published. He's like, publishers keep coming after me. I'm making tens of thousands of dollars a month in royalties. Mm. The math doesn't math, right? So publishers are kind of like, you've heard the saying about banks. It's like banks only lend money to people who don't need it. Well, publishers only give publishing deals to people who don't need the deal.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but that's my carve out. So if someone like Noah or someone that has a massive audience, maybe they say, hey, I've got a publisher that wants me to give me a six-figure or multi-six-figure advance. Well, then maybe it makes sense. Just know you're not going to keep any of the money from your royalties. You're going to lose a lot of control. But what most people will do is they'll say, I'm just going to use that advance and roll it into the book to do this huge splash, and then I'm going to make money on off all of the offshoots. So that's what I see a lot of people do.
So why? What are the reasons people are writing a book? I think there's going to be kind of like you could be an authority on a subject by like you give out a book. I know people who go speak and they give out a book instead of a business card.
Mm-hmm.
What are the reasons that people are writing the book?
Yeah, I think kind of three main reasons people write a book: legacy, passion, or business growth. right? So maybe it's the, something they want to pass down to their kids and grandkids. Mm-hmm. The passion is like, hey, this is a fun thing that I just kind of want to do. I've always wanted to do
it. It's like a fiction book or something.
Exactly. That's where a lot of our, this is our fiction book.
I said fiction, you literally pull up a book.
Yeah, pull up a book
of fiction. Nice, good time.
So we just launched this. This is, we've got a whole fiction arm of the company all about people who just want to write. They want to be writers. They would love to write full time. And then there's the business bucket, which is the majority of our business. And what we do is how do you use a book to strategically grow your business, get more leads, sales, and referrals. So whether you're a speaker, entrepreneur, et cetera, that's the wheelhouse of mostly what we do. And that's where it makes economic sense for most people because we can show them an ROI.
You mentioned fiction. Okay. I read way more fiction now in book form because I think all my business stuff comes from like scrolling X or Instagram or like the internet, right?
Yeah.
It's up to date by the second. You can actually, instead of hearing like what Elon Musk said in the New York Times, I just read what Elon Musk said. So I don't need this filter. I'm like, I'm the filter. So I skipped that whole distribution level and go directly to the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
Now, because of that, I'm like, I don't want to read a business book about AI because it's like, well, it's outdated. If it's four That's months old, it's like, hey, ChatGPT-2 is pretty awesome. you're already dead.
Yeah.
And so I've actually been reading a lot more fiction because I feel like it's timeless. It's talking about space or something like that. It doesn't matter when I read it. Are a lot more people publishing fiction now, or is like the business stuff, like what types of things are still selling in 2025?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the bestseller list on Amazon, the top 100 books, 90 or more of them will be fiction books.
Really? Right?
And so fiction is home run or strikeout, whereas business books are base hits, right? Use a baseball analogy. So I know if I work with a business author or self-help author, we can help them have a marginal level of success, maybe a huge level of success, depending on their resources and how hard they work it. Fiction, it might totally die on the vine with 100 readers and it might explode, but that's where the most popular and best-selling books are fiction books, right? But then I think, to your point, nonfiction, so it's got to be strategies, not tactics. So it's got to be timeless strategies. So I'm a little bit the opposite of you in some ways with consuming content because I want to find the problem in my life or in my business, find the best book on that, and then go deep on that thing. And then now AI for sure. That's like not a great corollary.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to do that in a book. Probably watch a bunch of YouTube videos or something. But then you go deep on the thing, you learn the thing, you get better at the thing. But
yeah, I've noticed, so for example, in the crypto world, there's this book that came out by Chris Dixon called Read, Write, Own. And he's part of A16Z, like a big venture capital thing. And I remember thinking, I was just like, man, he's releasing a book about crypto. Like in 1 year, this is going to be like a totally outdated, hilariously dumb book, right? So I read it just to see what it's about. And I was like, oh, man, he did a really, really good job, actually. He talked about just the concept of crypto.
Right.
He wasn't talking about like, because at the time, I think like NFTs were popular and stuff. And he kind of like mentioned them, but not like talked about them in the current form. Mm. He talked more about how the technology progressed through like stage one of the internet was just reading the internet. Stage two was interacting like on Facebook. Stage three was you can own a protocol. Like the SMT protocol for email, you can't own a piece of it. With Bitcoin or something, you can't. And so anyways, I saw he did that and I was like, oh, see, that's a timeless book. That book's going to last 10 plus years.
Super smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what we teach. And that's what I think people should do is you teach strategies, not tactics.
Yeah.
And so that's why all the time we'll tell people, hey, if you've got a course or a coaching program or something like that, you've already gotten a book. You just didn't know it yet. So just, but the course is the tactics. The click by click, right? And the book is the strategies, kind of more 10,000, 30,000 foot view. And even just my book is an example, right? It would be easy to put a bunch of screenshots of Amazon and all this
stuff.
Which
one is that? Published?
Published. Yeah, exactly.
But you got your logo pencil here.
Yeah. I love this. I need that. But I mean, it'd be easy to do that, but then it's going to be outdated to your point in 3 months or less. So that's, you lean into the strategies.
So you mentioned like the movie industry, the music industry, book industry, they're all changing because we have new technology that now your brother putting out music could just put it on SoundCloud, Spotify, YouTube, et cetera. We don't need those middlemen anymore. Yes. So like there's also different types of books. There used to be only physical books. And in the recent years, audiobooks and digital books have become like pretty commonplace. In fact, I hear more people saying they're like, oh, I read the book. I mean, well, I listened to it. A lot of people say that. I personally haven't listened to too many audiobooks myself, but I've been reading a ton of digital books on my Kindle. Mm-hmm. I love reading on the Kindle. I think it's awesome. I can preview the book beforehand so I can see if it sucks or not, and then buy it. Does that change the dynamic? Not at all. Any sort of change you've seen?
Yeah, big time. I think it changes the dynamic in a couple ways. And this is actually one of the biggest mistakes I see a lot of authors make is they don't publish in all formats, which is really dumb.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people that, oh, I got a print book, I got an ebook, maybe even a hardcover. I don't have an audiobook.
Why wouldn't they do that?
It's difficult. It's expensive. It takes time. It's all that stuff. Yeah. But a lot of people don't do that, especially in our world, self-published, right? Mm-hmm. And so you just miss out on this massive portion of the market, but then also your margin is way higher, right? Your margin on audiobooks and your margin on Kindle books, way higher than physical books. So I like them for different purposes. But we see that. There's many authors where, hey, the audiobook or the Kindle book or a combination of both is almost all of their royalties. Right. So I think it serves different purposes. Now, I want to have a physical book because I want to put this book in the hands of every prospect and customer that exists. And especially for some of our authors, you're selling really high end stuff. It's like, well, the cheat code is get a physical copy of this book in the decision makers' hands of all the buyers in your market. And your business is going to explode. So it's a little bit tougher to do that with ebook or audio. But on a whole, Those platforms are exploding.
Because if you're self-publishing and you have like an EPUB book, like the format for ebook,
yeah.
I mean, you can go on Fiverr or something and just get it formatted for print, right?
Totally.
Like it's not
a
really technically hard thing. I think it's tedious.
Yeah,
but
once again,
you can hire people that are pro. That's what I did. I hired someone
exactly.
who's just a pro. And for like $100, they did it for me and it looked great. And I was like, oh,
right.
Great.
Right. And it's, you got to do a good, I would say you got to do a good job of it. So don't take the shortcuts of just copy paste converter style, but you do that. Yeah.
The audiobook I would say is the hardest.
Yes.
Because then you got to sit there and read it. You probably have to have a studio that's doing it correctly.
Yeah.
I guess you could do it on like a MacBook or something.
Format it for audio too. Even just small things, right? Like as you see below. Well, you can't say that in an audio.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like a bunch of different things like that. Or sometimes my favorite is when people have call to action in their book and they didn't think about this and it's a really dumb, long link.
Oh, yeah.
So like, just go to .com/\.
Well, I had a problem when I was reading my ebook. A lot of pictures.
Yeah.
I'm like, so this graph, and I'm like, oh, shit, I got to like tell them what's on this graph now. Now I got to like NPR style describe it. This graph.
And not to get too into the weeds, but there's two things we do there. One, you can have there's a little PDF thing that you can attach it to with Audible so that they can just pull it up and it's a visual aid. But then what we'll also do is at the very beginning of every audiobook, and this is actually really good for pull through and for leads and stuff, is I'll just give a disclaimer. Hey, this is a really visual book. You're going to want the visuals. So I'll actually just give you the PDF for free. Go here. I just use it as an opt-in. And it helps with a lot of leads, but then it also helps give them the visuals that they probably want anyway.
What about, okay, so I'm going to ask you a question that has a wide range of answers. How much money do people make with books?
Are we talking about royalties only or business?
So obviously there's going to be like Atomic Habits, James Clear, selling 20 million copies and making crazy money off of it. Most people who self-publish, let's not talk about the outliers. Mm-hmm. Oprah publishes a book. Okay, that's Oprah. Let's talk about the average person. Are they making money on a book, like some here and there, or they're making no money but just giving them out? Like what are these money ranges, some examples you can give with certain books?
Most books don't make money. In terms of the royalties that come from the actual book. Now, if we're talking business self-help book, they make a ton of money, but not on the royalties themselves, right? It's all the business. So it's lead sales referrals for the business.
Oh, so someone puts out a book about a certain topic, like about sleep hacking or something, and then someone hires them off the book.
So this book has brought in about $7 million over the last 12 months, tens of millions total for the business.
Mm-hmm.
99% of that is in the business, not the royalties.
But
right?
what would that book make, like, if you don't mind me asking, like on Amazon?
I don't even know the recent numbers, but probably couple thousand bucks a month.
Okay.
Right? So it's like nothing to write home about. But the main thing for me is the business that comes from the book. So I'd say, I guess to maybe more directly answer your question specific to royalties and book sales, this is kind of a crazy stat, but the average self-published book sells like 100 copies.
Whoa.
That's not a lot.
Sucks. Yeah, really bad.
Yeah.
And then if you're, you know, 1,000 copies is kind of like a decent benchmark. And then for any genre, 10,000 copies is good. Mm. Kind of to your point earlier that you were making, traditionally, even traditionally published, like if you traditionally publish a book, you sell 10,000 copies, it's like, cool.
Huh.
Base hit, that's kind of like break even or better.
Yeah, I'm feeling good about my book now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah. You are the 1%, right, with that book. Because if you think about it, publishers are actually very similar to venture capitalists. So almost the exact same model, right? You place 10 bets, 8 of them are losers, maybe even more than that. 2 of them are base hits, so you get like a 2 to 3Xer, and then you hope that you get one that's a unicorn, right? And that's how they make money. It's all the money off of the unicorn. But what's interesting about that model is everyone's pissed, right? If I'm the 8 people where it sucked, well, I'm blaming the publisher, and now I don't have the rights, and I'm like, well, this just sucks. Like, not only are they not selling, but I can't even do anything with it. Then if I'm the unicorn, well, I'm also pissed because it's selling all of these copies and they're making all the money, right? So that's kind of how I think about it in terms of strictly royalties, but that's where the lion's share comes on the back end with the business.
Now, I'll say in terms of like, you know, everyone loves the passive income, like you do one thing and then forever it returns money. I've done all sorts of like passive income things. They're not very passive in my opinion.
Yes.
They'll return for a while and then it kind of tapers off.
Yeah.
This book has consistently brought in between $300 and like $1,000
every
month.
Yeah.
I don't promote it. I guess right now I'm technically kind of promoting it, but like, I don't really like talk about it all that much. I don't really push it. And it just, the Amazon machine sells it.
Yeah.
And I think because they see it has a high click-through rate, people see the topic, they buy it, and they're like, okay, so out of 100 people that came to this page, 40 people bought it. Let's keep showing this. Mm-hmm. I assume that's how Amazon works.
100%. Well, I love that you said that because I think passive income is pretty much a myth. I mean, there's just no such thing in 99.9% of instances, but a book is the closest thing I've seen to passive income.
If it's like kind of like a minor hit. Like,
yeah, totally.
You got like the Amazon will keep just promoting it. Right?
Yeah. When even, I mean, if you think about it, even if it sells 100 copies in a random month, 3 years from now, okay, well, a few bucks a book, that's a few $100.
And you don't do anything. You don't handle returns. Like Amazon, I don't know what they do, but it's handled.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
So this has been one of the most passive income things. So it's not hard for people to think like, hey, you know, if I write a series of 10 different books, the ratios would work out that one's going to be good, 2 will be meh, the rest will be crap. But like that could sustain a living. Are there people you know that like sustain a living just from book royalties,
100%.
Not from like off books?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, we've got a bunch of authors that we work with that do that. And then we've got multiple coaches on our team that they are full-time authors. And they coach because it's fun and it also makes money, but they're full-time authors. I mean, this is an example of this. Ari Vance, he runs the fiction side of the business. Mm-hmm. This is kind of we've got full-time authors on the nonfiction side of the business that are coaches, exactly the model that you're talking about. They've written, I don't even know how many, 10, 20, 30 books.
Oh,
and you're cross-selling, right? It's just like having multiple SKUs of a product. The fiction side of things, Rami is a full-time author, Ari Vance. I want to say last year, it was either 60 or 80,000 copies of his books that he sold. Mm-hmm. Fiction. We're talking fiction. But fiction is all about read-through. So it's, you got to have a good first-selling book in the series, and then you throw all your money and marketing at the first. And then you say, okay, 60% are going to read book 2. Once they get to book 2, 80, 90% are going to read book 3, book 4, book 5, if you're a decent writer, right? So then it becomes a kind of some arbitrage of, okay, can I break even on book 1? And then my read-through's dialed in and then kind of feeds this whole machine of selling.
I'm on the third series of a book called The Fossil that I'm currently reading. And I read the first one. I was like, that was good. I may as well read The Fossil 2. And then like, you know, The Fossil 3 is right now next. So I just keep going down the rabbit hole.
Totally.
I've given this guy 20-something bucks. I mean, I think they're like cheap Kindle books for like $7 each.
Yeah.
But like I bought several things plus the other book series he had. And I just—
Probably up to $100, maybe two. It's the classic, you've heard there's, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this concept. There's only 3 ways to grow a business, right? You can either get more customers, you can increase your average order value, or you can increase the lifetime value of the business. Mm-hmm. Those are the three ways. Same thing with books, right? You can either sell more books, you can increase your average order value. Okay, well, that's different formats or bundles or whatever. Lifetime value is read-through rate. So how do you turn that one book purchaser into whatever you've, yeah, how many ever of these.
And now I'm like, I look up that guy's something Calvert, I forgot his name, but like I just click his thing in the Kindle store and see any other 5-star book he has. I'm like, yeah, okay, insta download.
Totally.
Just because I know I like that other book.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Neville here. And let me tell you something about making all this content. It costs time and money and effort to make all of these things, and we put them out for free. For example, to film this costs money. To edit this costs money. To spend the time uploading it to all the different social networks costs time and human capital and money and software and all kinds of stuff. And all I ask for you in return is to just like, subscribe, and comment to something. This is a free way that you can return to me. You never have to buy anything from me ever. But I really do ask that you just click the like button. It's free for you. Or maybe even leave a comment. Or maybe share it with someone. These are all ways that really, really help me out, but cost you nothing. And it's a great way to return the favor. So if you like whatever I do over here, just make sure to like, subscribe, comment on all the different platforms. And that means the world to me. Thank you so much. I hope to keep informing you, educating, and entertaining. Talk to you later.
So obviously, you help a lot of people do the book stuff, but you've also scaled like your own business. I think you've done $70 million in revenue over the last couple of years or something like that with selfpublishing.com. I remember when it was self-publishing school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody remembers. Nobody calls it selfpublishing.com.
Dude, I have a company called Copywriting Courses with K's originally, and everyone still calls it that. Like, what happened to the K's? So trust me, I know.
Like, it was a weird thing. There was this whole writing.
I like self-publishing school because it's like self-publishing, how to do it, school.
Yeah.
And then SPS was a cool, like,
yeah,
little, like,
so which brand do you think is better, and what did we screw up in getting people to call it self-publishing?
You know what I think it is? For me, I have a community and have a company called Copywriting Course with K's. So the Copywriting Course Community has a weird acronym. And for years, like it was almost like a joke because I'm like, I don't know, look at me. Like, I don't know. Like, you get the joke. Like, I'm not like
Brown guy is the leader of the KKK. Yeah. Got it.
Circa 2020, things got a little sensitive in the world. And dude, companies would tell me, they're like, it's KK. I'm like, but it's
2Ks.
And they're like,
we stopped short of the third.
2Ks was too much. I'm telling you. And I actually had to spring for the domain copywriting course, even though, dude, I really loved having like a weird name.
Yeah.
I loved having it. I'm sure with self-publishing school, people thought of like that's the thing, and then no one's 100%. Calling it selfpublishing.com as much.
It's been really hard. I'm like, well, am I an idiot? Does the rebrand suck? Is it a worse name, or is it just, I don't know.
You know what I think? I don't think people give a shit.
That's probably
I don't think anyone outside of you, Tanner, and your team care at all about your name.
Yeah,
dude, Sumo Me. Remember, I was part of Sumo, a product called Sumo Me. And then it changed to sumo.com. And with this big hubbub to get the domain name, there's a big negotiation. It was millions of dollars. Gone. Like, it's like no one cared. No one, at first, you're like, wow, you got sumo.com. And back to normal.
Yeah.
No one cares about that. And like, I still call it Sumo Me. That product was in my head was Sumo Me. I think just most people don't care.
It's a good point.
Yeah. Like it's like a
you
thing
try to
you
get them
care
to care.
About.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, I've thought about okay, should we do ads or I've thought jingles. I'm like, oh man, I remember these jingles still. So we do selfpublishing.com or we do like my mashup of like selfpublishing.com and selfpublishing.com because I mean, I need our own staff.
Convert Kit to Kit.
Oh yeah,
I think Kit's cool, but also like Convert Kit made me think of like conversion rate.
Yes,
I just like it had like that alliteration going on.
I always thought that was a great name.
Yeah,
which I know Nathan, he's a great guy, but I remember they changed it to Seva, or whatever,
and they got in trouble because it was like some Indian term or something like that.
Something,
and then they backtracked on it, and then I guess Kit's a cool name, but like. I liked ConvertKit.
Kit is better than Seva or whatever the other name is. But I mean, I'm with you. It's still not as good as ConvertKit. Because, well, we convert. It's a kit to optimize conversion of your website. Like, okay, you instantly get it. Which makes me think of titles. It's like a good title. People instantly understand what the book's about, whether or not it's for them.
How do you, so let's say someone comes to you with like five titles. How do you, is it just like a gut instinct of like, that's a better title?
Which one's clear, not clever? So do people instantly get it? And the title needs to be clear, but then the subtitle needs to be really clear. So people, and the more niche, the better, all that stuff. I mean, I think yours is definitely clear, not clever. I mean, this book will teach you how to write
better. These are both very clear, not clever. This book will teach you how to write better, and you're going to die.
Well, what's the subtitle on your
framework for happiness?
Okay. Yeah, this is straightforward. Right? You instantly understand what the book's about.
Yeah. And actually on the back, I remember it's just like it says you plus this book write better. Now stop reading the back and start taking notes and applying what's on the inside. I remember thinking,
copywriter, man.
Can't be more clear than that.
Yeah.
Right? So
it's a superpower, yeah.
Okay. So it's much like headlines. When people show us like a headline or a web page, they're like, which of these is better? I'm like, the one that I just understand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think I learned this from you as well. It's the Joe Sugarman slippery slope, right? The job of the title is to get them to read the subtitle. The job of the subtitle is to get them to either flip to the back, or if you're on the listing, well, then let me read the first little bit. And then the job of that is to either get them to the look inside feature, like you talked about earlier. So maybe I start skimming the first chapter, or maybe I swoop down to the reviews, see what's going on there, and then I make a decision to purchase or not. Really, it's all of that. Either I'm going to stay on that book page for 15 seconds and leave, or I'm going to pick up this book for 15 seconds and put it down, or I'm going to keep it for a minute and a half and buy, or stay on the page for a minute and a half and buy. So it's all the same copywriting stuff.
But you know what's interesting? Like for us, like with web pages, you go log into Framer or Lead Pages, whatever, you update that headline in 2 seconds. You could split test it really easy online and be like, this version worked better than the other. With a book, it feels like the stakes are a lot higher, because that's your book. Like, don't judge a book by its cover, but that's what people judge it by, because that's the only thing to go on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, that must be a stressful decision to be like, should it be called This Book Will Teach You How to Write It Better, or The 10 Commandments of Copywriting? Like, what? How do y'all play that out?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times we'll have people vote on the title, vote on the cover, but even that it's unscientific. And honestly, the biggest benefit of that is you're sneakily marketing the book.
Sly marketing.
And you get all these people engaged, and it's like really good for engagement. But you also start to see some cream rise to the top. So that's one thing we'll do. Secondly, a lot of times what I'll tell people is explain your book to your friend or someone you know that's the ideal target market. Explain it to them for 2.5 minutes, record the conversation, listen to it. Your title's in there. It's not in the thing that you create when you go to title land and kind of try to come up with this fancy title. And so there's that. But then there's the third thing, which is, I remember this way back from Tim Ferriss way back in the day, is you can just split test the headlines. You can just pay for some ads.
Yeah, that's true.
To just split test the headlines.
Noah did that similar thing with his book. And that's why it's like a green color.
Yeah.
Because they split tested it a bunch on Facebook. They spent like $100 on Facebook ads. It was like pretty cheap. Yeah.
Grabs attention. It's green cover. Right.
You know what they also did? They kind of photoshopped it on like a bookstore shelf, and they were like, okay, if it's yellow, and there was like a bunch of other yellow books, and because it was like puke green, for lack of a better word, it just really stood out. And you're like, all right, I could tell. And then they use that as the basis of everything.
That's another smart thing that a lot of time we'll have designers do. Say, okay, let's go for the top 10 books in this category. Mm-hmm. Put the cover options in that, and let me look at that and see if it grabs attention, stands out, all that stuff.
You know, for this one, I actually was going to call it the 10 Commandments of Copywriting because it was 10 chapters, whatever. Mm-hmm. I had the whole thing planned out, and I made a biblical looking thing with like, I don't know, who's the guy with the ark? Noah's ark.
Noah, yeah.
He had like the 10 Commandments of Copywriting. It was like a tablet. Yeah. I had it like designed, and someone on Fiverr made it and everything. I was so proud of it. And in my newsletter at the time for copywriting course, I was like, which of these do you like? Just respond to me. It's the worst survey ever, literally just responses. 90% of people said they liked that cover. And that was just a placeholder cover that I had to put in the software. I just needed a cover. And I just did that real quick one day. I just wrote it out. And everyone loved that cover. And so it wasn't like 51% versus 49%. It was 90% of people said that one. So I was like, all right, the people have spoken.
Yeah.
Pretty easy.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward.
So there's all these different things to put out a book. So in your company, I'm assuming you have to hire writers, editors, book design, like how many, what is the levels of these companies? What are the different roles that you have to employ?
Are you talking about from the consumer or from like our business?
For your business, like you're a big company now. I think you've got like, what, 20 plus people or something like that?
We have 60 something people.
Damn.
Yeah. Wow. So we've got about 60 people. I think maybe more than that, maybe 65 or something like that. We've got basically, if you look at the org chart, there's product team, which is exists of coaching and then book production, fulfillment. So then that's all the things that you're talking about. Editors, cover designers, formatters, all the things that we help people. The kind of, we call it the final mile of publishing. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of like the product fulfillment arm. There's sales team, marketing team, and then ops finance. It's kind of like the org chart, but.
Nice. So how many like salespeople do you have versus people actually like creating books and stuff? Yeah. Like business people do you have versus like tactical people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I would say our sales to coaching ratio is pretty close, or coaching and author success. Mm-hmm. So we've got probably 10 to 12 coaching and author success people who are kind of our guides, mm-hmm. you know, to use story brand Donald Miller kind of terminology. So we got the guides guiding the authors through the process. That is pretty equal to the sales team.
Okay.
So sales fulfillment. And then we've got probably another 10 to 12 on the actual production team to just make sure that the books are really quality. And
for like the guides, is there a job to be like, call you in 2 weeks and be like, hey, Neville, remember that book you were going to publish?
Exactly.
What's exactly. happening with it?
Exactly.
Because I feel like that's where I got flat. I'm just like, I got this big idea and then it's like hard work. And then I'm like, yeah, forget
totally.
It. Yeah.
I mean, that's a big part of why people pay us.
It's like a personal trainer. You know all these exercises or you can look them up on YouTube, but like having a guy there just staring at you working out.
Yeah.
There is some power to that.
And that's, I always make the joke. I say, hey, what's selfpublishing.com? Well, it's kind of like a mix between Indiana Jones and Jillian Michaels. And so Indiana Jones, we blaze the trail. Our goal was to save you a ton of time, money, and energy. But then Jillian Michaels and I show this slide, and she's like screaming at this person saying, do the work.
Who's Jillian Michaels?
You know, are you kidding me?
Is that the
Biggest
lady?
Loser? You didn't watch The Biggest Loser growing up?
I was letting you finish the analogy, but I was like, this is the worst analogy I've ever heard in my life.
Really? Man, maybe I need to reexamine that analogy.
Maybe I'm just bad. I sort of got the Indiana Jones one. You need a woman skirt level analogy for that. You need to retool that one, I think.
Have you heard of Jillian Michaels? Okay.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm the odd man out.
You never watched.
Okay, never mind.
Is this, yeah. The Biggest Loser? You ever heard of that show?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's maybe like a white people watch that.
Indian it's people like, are getting fat. We got it too. I actually stayed on the place where they filmed the first thing called Casamigos Ranch or Calamigos Ranch or whatever.
The first Biggest Loser.
They actually got up such a tangent, but they basically had this beautiful property where they filmed it and they needed place for people to stay. So they brought in like portable modular housing that was like, it's like trailers essentially.
Oh, yeah.
And then someone got the bright idea of like, let's just charge people a lot of money to stay here. And they like decked out these trailers and made them all nice. And I stayed there for roughly $2,000 a night. Yeah. So Biggest Loser, me paying for this place. Yeah.
The Biggest Loser is the people who pay $2,000 a night to come.
Never seen the show though. So yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So, okay. So obvious question with like book writing AI, like what in your, I got some questions here, but like in your opinion, how has like that entered the fold? Big impact, no impact? Like what have you seen?
I think AI has in some ways completely changed the game and in other ways not changed it at all. I mean, I think it makes it easier to create crap. So kind of homogenized yeah. crap. But then if you use it correctly, it can help level up every facet of your book, right? And so where we see people using it really well, and even where we're using it, is to create outlines for the content, right? Mm-hmm. To create really good titles. It's really good at titles. We've got this, a title generator on our website that is just repurposing AI with some prompts and stuff. And then mm-hmm. people type in what their book's about and it spits out a bunch of titles. So that's a really good use of it. Editing, it's really good at editing, and especially more linear type editing, so the less skill that's needed in editing, but even just giving feedback on overall manuscripts. Mm-hmm. So some people on our team are using that and using that to assist their feedback with our authors. And so I think that's really interesting. You can certainly use it to write drafts, but it's got to be prompted really, really well. So it can be helpful to get a first draft, but only with really good prompts. And I think this is just my stance. Some people say, oh, just publish a bunch of crap and just win in a volume game. That's not how we recommend that people win. It's like, hey, write the best book possible. And so how do you use AI to improve the quality of the book that you're publishing is kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, because I feel like you could probably get AI to write like these sizes of books. I mean, I could probably make it write 10 of these.
Totally.
But then the problem is like, okay, I got to go market it. I have to make it sell.
Yeah.
Right. That's ultimately kind of the goal. And how many of those are going to be like bangers? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I know with AI, like obviously we run a writing company, so we see a lot of people use it. And it's great in ways I didn't expect and bad in ways I thought were going to be really good. So just writing a whole book for you, it generally is not that
interesting. What are you seeing on the copywriting side of things? What are the ways it's great that you didn't expect forgive me, you said.
Yeah, yeah. So here's one. When I do the show notes for this podcast, I get the final video and I take notes just for me, just for Neville. Like, I'm just like, I want to remember this conversation. You said some cool stuff. I like to put it down in notes just for my thing. And I go manually listen to it, maybe at 2x speed sometimes, and then take notes. And then I used to send those notes to my email list because I'm like, hey, here's this cool thing. If you don't want to watch it, then read the notes at least. Mm. And then with AI, what I did was I was just like, wait, can we get it to make pictures of you and me and visualize all those? Now, there's no way in hell I'd make 40 custom images for show notes because I don't make money on that or anything.
Yeah.
This is a lot of work for kind of nothing. With AI, guess what it's really good at? Making a bunch of images that I don't want to make.
Interesting.
And so we actually end up making these show notes that people like. So it's like a headline, that's my note, and then a visualization of that note.
Huh.
And it's easy for people to kind of like skim it, almost like social media. It's like headline thing, headline image. Huh. And I just go through the entire interview. And a lot of times it increases viewership because someone's like, I'm not going to watch this book guy's thing. And then they read a thing about how you're picking titles and they're like, oh, I'm going to go just check that part out.
Mm.
And so it actually increases viewership, and I never would make all these custom images. So that's a way that like it increases my ability to make these like crappy, they're not the greatest images in the world, but they do the job. But I would never do that for show notes. To rewrite my whole newsletter with, I thought like, let me see if the AI can rewrite my whole newsletter. And there's this, I can't identify what it is, but this feeling of crappiness and just like kind of mediocrity that it gives. Currently. Now, like in 2 years, I don't know. Maybe we're talking a different thing. But it does give this kind of like, man, I write so different than this thinks I do.
That's interesting because I'd be curious to see how you could train it. Because, I mean, as you are an elite copywriter with a super distinct voice, which feels like kind of an outlier for how most people use AI.
Well, if you say write this like Neville Medora, a lot of times it goes, what's up? Like, it uses like really over-exaggerated things. And you can kind of prompt it to be like, all right, tone it down, things like that, and get it to write sort of like that. But it's like someone making like a caricature of you.
Yeah.
I feel like.
Oh, that's interesting.
I do wonder, like, let's say you input like Felix Denick's How to Get Rich. He had this really great way of writing. I mean, just unbelievable writer. Can it emulate that? And I think the answer is going to be yes at some point.
Yeah.
So, but at the moment, I do also feel, and maybe just because like I like writing, I do also feel like part of writing is this like, I like organizing my thoughts and getting it into words. And I think there's more to it than just putting words on a page, but rather it's just like me organizing my thoughts, telling stories, writing them down and being like, oh, that's not an interesting story.
Oh,
and then being like, oh, that's the interesting part.
Mm-hmm.
So writing is thinking.
And so you're saying the hardest part is finding the hook or finding the interesting part of that story. And that is the part that AI is not doing that you feel like.
Currently. I always preface this with currently. AI is like, what, 2.5 years old?
Right.
So it's still like an infant. So I don't want to say I'll never do that. But it is a great sparring partner. I do think one thing that it's, whenever I just raw come up with an idea by myself, just sit there and try to think of an idea, it's vastly different than what the AI says usually. And so there is like a gulf between what I create and then what it creates. So that always worries me that like if I rely too heavily on AI, does it kind of go away? Or in the future, like, you know, right now on LinkedIn, everyone's just like, you're just making a ChatGPT project saying, hey, I'm going to talk about this concept about what I do to make a bunch of podcasts. And then it makes a post.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just start seeing these over and over and it becomes homogenized.
Yeah.
And right now there's like, if you're a little ahead of the game, you can kind of get into it, but everyone will eventually have that capability.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, well, what sets you apart then? And I have a feeling that like, if you kind of zig while everyone's zagging on this one, that you have a very unique human style. And then like, even my old dumb drawings, I'm like, I think those might be more important than ever. because now everyone has the capability with AI to make drawings, but there's still something weirdly charming about the old school drawings.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wonder, like, will that come back when everyone has this capability to produce well grade 12 English stuff?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. On a totally separate but related note, I wonder if you could upload all...
Already tried it. I already know where you're going. All of my images and have it replicate it, right?
Oh, no. I was going to say all of your AppSumo emails that you wrote.
I think probably absorbed most of them. Yeah.
I mean, I think I've told you this before, but I can't think of a newsletter that I read every single email.
Yeah.
Before and since then. And that was one of them. Like, I'll never forget when you're writing those emails.
Yeah.
So they were. Like, I'm every day or however frequently you guys were sending them. I mean,
from the internet.
I bet you did. They were a riot, man.
I feel like 2012 was a different time. We
it's
got
like
away
watching
with
the
crazy
office.
Stuff. Yeah.
It's like going back and watching The Office. And
first seasons of Office, they have them on planes, like on Delta and stuff. You're just like, Jesus Christ.
You could never do that now.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it sounds like you are using AI for certain things in there, but rewriting someone's whole book is probably not the way.
It's not the highest, best use currently. Now, if you don't care about the quality so much, sure, you can use it. You can prompt it. You can get it to be a C-. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you can edit it and all that stuff. But if that's good enough, cool, publish it. That's not the primary of what we do, but we use it for all the other stuff. Titles, outlines, descriptions, giving feedback on writing style, editing, a lot of stuff.
Yeah. That's super interesting, man. Dude, let's go over some, you brought a couple of books over here. Mm-hmm. Let's go over some examples. Like, maybe what would be cool is like we hold the book up, talk about it, maybe a little something interesting about it. Maybe if you know some like money stats, like rough, like how much money it made or business it brought in or something like that, that could be cool.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I'll start with this one, which is mine. This is my favorite book of all time.
Hold that up to that. There we go. Nice.
My favorite book of all time. We always say books change lives. This book changed my life. It's brought in about 7 million over the last 12 months, tens of millions over the last few years. I mean, this is.
And like $1,000 in royalties per month. Or
something like that.
Something.
Yeah. I mean, more than that. I don't even honestly look at that number because it's all about the business.
Must be
so
nice.
That's
bro.
A big one. And then I would say, gosh, there's a bunch of different ones. I try to bring some ones in different genres. So I'll start with this one. We ironically do a bunch of books in the real estate space.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's called Skip the Flip. This is a guy, Hayden Crabtree. He had a real estate investing philosophy, as you could guess, is about skipping the flip. So skip house flipping and do this instead, right? Really good book, actually. Really easy read. The book, sure, sold decently well. I think he was doing a few thousand dollars a month in royalties, but it opened up. He got on the Bigger Pockets podcast from this book.
Nice.
He, I want to say, did six figures in course sales within the first year. And it was, okay, you buy the book, you read the book, and then people say, well, okay, this is helpful, but can you teach me it more in depth? So they would buy the course. And then use this. He's got like a software company, a fund, and all that stuff. Used it for the fund. It's a huge fundraiser because, I mean, as you guess, a bunch of people will read the book, say, oh, yeah, I really like this strategy. I don't want to do the work. Can I just pay you or can I just invest with you? So that's a big one. Hayden Crabtree, he's killed it. It's a fun one in the real estate investing
space. He's like triple dipping. He's making money off the book, some small amount,
yes.
But then getting core sales, and then ultimately probably like investors who are like, here's $1 million.
Yes.
You go do that thing for me.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's a big... We ironically do a bunch in the real estate investing space.
It kind of makes sense because like the transaction volume is so high.
You're teaching a philosophy, right? And so it's how do you get someone to invest with you? Well, they got to trust you. Well, how do you get someone to know, like, and trust you? They read the book. And then, so you just send this to all your potential investors. They invest with you, right? So that's a fun one. I would say on a totally different note, this is an interesting one. This is a memoir. So this is Karen Wilkerson. I think... it's a memoir on faith, love, and advocating through a health crisis. I think this was related to COVID and her husband having COVID. I hope we don't get this episode started or something now. But super interesting because a lot of times we tell people memoirs don't sell. Who cares? You know what I'm saying? Like, unless you're, gosh, what's his name? Matthew McConaughey, mm-hmm. or some famous person. Your memoir isn't going to sell because mm-hmm. nobody really cares. You're not famous. But so we always say a couple things. One, your memoir isn't about you. It's about your readers.
What does that mean?
Basically, like, a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to write a memoir because I got to tell my story. It's like, well, no one cares about your story if you're not famous. What are the themes in your story that people would actually care about? And then let's find those themes. Let's write a book about that and let's market to those themes. So this is really interesting. Karen did an incredible job. I'm forgetting the stats offhand. A few hundred reviews within the first few months of launch. Nice. I want to say I saw the stat the other day and I almost couldn't believe it. It was like 100 speaking gigs and podcast interviews or something that booked off of the book.
And like people read it and then wanted her to come speak?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so that like exactly. launched
her. I mean, it launched all kinds of stuff for her. And it's a memoir. So that's, I love sharing that one because it's a really, really interesting and unique one. I would say this is probably one of my favorites. This is a great book, Elisa DiLorenzo. This is a great example of a lot of people come to us or they don't come to us and work with us because they've already published books before. Uh-huh. So they think, well, okay, I know how to do this. Why would I work with you guys? Elisa and her husband, Tony, they had published a few different books. The books did decently well, mm-hmm. But they said, hey, I know that you guys have a process that we think the books will do better. And so they published this book with us. It did better than all the other books combined.
Wow.
So I think they've already moved. They keep reaching out and they're like, oh, the numbers are wrong. It's actually way more. Like every time we share the story, right? This is a really fun thing. We got to keep updating that testimonial. But last I heard, it was 60,000 copies, probably more than that.
So that's definitely top 1%. That's 0.01%.
Oh my gosh,
books. That's
0.01% of all books, right? But it's a great book. They use this to launch speaking career. It's feeding the podcast. They've got conferences. It's like they're helping marriage conferences, all that stuff. It's a great book.
And as they speak, they probably sell more books in that room because you're like, oh, what are these things? And then you just buy the book and
yeah, yeah.
It's like you're low
ticket
offer.
Man. Maybe you need to read this one.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I know you got no problems for being fruitful and multiplying, but that's a really good one. but yeah, so that those are a couple. I mean, then there's other random ones like this one's a buddy of mine, Hunter Ballou, has a company on scaling, so unlocking 8 figures. This is a straight down the fairway. Use the book to bring in lead sales and referrals for your business. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a lot of our.
I mean, he's like giving them out.
Oh yeah, like this is. I want to get this book in the hands of prospects, customers, employees.
Got it.
That's kind of how we think about it. People who are considering doing business with you are exponentially more likely to do business with you once they read the book. Then if they're customers, well, how do we give the book to them so that it expedites the onboarding process and gives leverage to your whole team, mm-hmm. right? And then thirdly, how do you give the, I mean, this is how I think about it with my book as well, give the book to every new employee. It's day one, week one onboarding is read the book. Now you're speaking like us. You've got the frameworks. You kind of understand everything at a 10,000 foot view. So he's doing a great job of that. And there's kind of a couple others. This is Dr. Jonathan Sue. Really interesting. A lot of people come to us when they want to go from one-to-one to one-to-many. Mm-hmm. Just like bring leverage. So he was doing all these exercises with people, physical therapists, and thought, hey, how do I scale this beyond my practice room? And so he did this. It's done really, really well. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. 6-minute fitness at 60 plus. You instantly know what the book's about, right? And this is one of the most niche books. It's like we have another book that has 1,000 or 2,000 reviews. It's on starting a mobile notary company. So I'm like, I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah.
It's so niche. It exploded. His business exploded kind of like this. It's just like what we found with all these thousands of books is the more specific you are, the better it is.
I kind of want that book because I watch all these videos on being limber and stuff like that. And it's like a 25-year-old. And I'm like,
totally.
I love your video, but you're 25.
Exactly.
I want an old-ass guy who's older than me who's still limber because I'm like, okay, that's the person I want to emulate.
Yeah.
And they're not 25.
Right.
And so, like, I saw that and I was like, that's kind of exactly what I was looking for, like a daily routine that's not 50 minutes long that I could just do for the rest of my life to be limber. And I was like, I was looking at that and I was like, damn, that nailed it.
Well, and that's what's interesting, right? Is a lot of people think the more specific I am, I'm going to alienate the whole audience. Mm. So it's not going to sell. And we find it's exactly the opposite. The more specific you are, the better it sells. And a weird byproduct is when you are so specific, you have people who are outside of that specificity that want to buy the book. Like you, right? You're not 60 plus.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, hey, I want to read this. Right? And so it's kind of counterintuitive.
You're totally right. If this is like a boardroom meeting, they'll be like, no, you're alienating the whole totally. Crowd. They're, the 45 demographic is really high, whatever. And yeah, they would fucking
and
all
they would just
yeah.
maybe say 6 minute fitness. Well, what if we just said 6 minute fitness? Let's cut out the S60 plus. We need mass appeal, right? That's what a traditional publisher would say. No, it's like sniper, not a shotgun, right?
Yeah.
And the last one, this is ironically, you know, it's so funny. You start a business and you think that you're going to have customers that all are like you. Mm-hmm. And then you, I don't know if this is the same as for you, but for me, it's the biggest demographic for us is 50 plus year old women who want to write about their life experience, whether that's memoir or self-help. So this is kind of a really great example of that, where it's kind of, you know, memoir self-help-ish, a little bit of a hybrid, but this is a lot of our business. So we've got Jeff, who's the business owner who wants to write a book to grow their business. And then we call her Susie. This is Susie.
And why does Susie, like, I get why Jeff wants to put it out. Why does Susie want to put it out?
Impact, right? So it's, we were talking about kind of like legacy, passion, and business is the three reasons why people write. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a legacy and passion project, where a lot of times with Susie, we find that she's 50 plus, her husband's getting into the age of about to retire. Mm-hmm. She's getting to the age of being an empty nester. Mm-hmm. She wants to use all this life experience and make an impact and almost like birth a second career kind of thing. And it's meaningful to her. It helps people. And a lot of times they'll get into that and then realize, hold up, there's a whole business here. But
man, this is getting me jazzed up to write like another book. I'm just like, I'm a writer. I feel like writing a book kind of makes sense. I guess this is why your company exists. This exact yeah. thing of like, I have the book in mind that I'm like, I don't think it'd be the best seller in the world, but it's very specific. And I think it's actually very useful. And it would be that size. And just writing it is very hard. And I guess that's why your company exists. That's why people pay you thousands of bucks 100%. To like get you yeah. to do the thing. And I feel like I have the structure to where like, I should be the one that should be able to put out books this quickly. Someone who's not a writer that doesn't do this for a living, doesn't have an audience, probably needs way more help
yeah.
than someone like me, and I still can't get it done. So you picked a good niche.
Sometimes you just need accountability, right? Is your book specific to the business?
It was kind of like, in 30 minutes, how do you write better?
Mm.
And so from running copywriting course for years, I was just like, I noticed like there's basically like 10 lessons that I show people and like that gets them better. It's just like really quick concepts.
Cool. Yeah.
Right. So from that, that's where this came from. And it's kind of funny because we'll have these bulk buys and it's people giving them to their salespeople.
Oh.
Yeah. And people still send me like a picture of the book, just like propping up a desk or something like that. But they're like, but we're still reading it, giving it out. Yeah.
That's cool.
Still using it.
That's cool.
And there is something... There's something weird of all the things I've done. You're sitting on my bookshelf in my office. There'll be a tiny book and someone grabs it and they're like, you wrote this? And like, it blows people's minds.
It's a weird feeling.
Because to me, it's just a blog post. I literally wrote it in a Google Doc.
I'll never forget when I was looking for houses and we were looking at this house and then we found out the house next door was for sale. So my realtor's like, let's just go over there. Let's look at it right now. And the people were home. And she'd introduced me as an author. Oh. And when I came over there, they were like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I've ever met an author before. Like, you're an author. Do you have a book? Can I get a book signed? All this stuff. It's just a weird thing because I'm like, I would never introduce myself as an author.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an entrepreneur or whatever. But that was when it really clicked for me is people just see this differently. They see that identity differently. So it's the same kind of for you when they're in your office and they grab a copy of your book and it's, oh my gosh, you wrote this. It's just this weird, because most people don't know authors.
You know, for this one, you're going to die. it was kind of like a theory on life of like, I found out, and this is like you said, Jeff and Susie, Jeff is the business owner. This book was written for like
money, like how to write better sales.
That's your Jeff book.
That's my Jeff book. This is my Susie book. And I never really talk about it all that much because it's not like something I'm trying to push down people's throats. It's just kind of like, this is how I approach life. I thought it'd be interesting to share if you like it, if not. And the reason I made it was over the years, and I think this is where AI probably would have messed up a little currently, is it's like I would talk about this concept of like I wanted to kill myself at 85. Mm. And when you say you want to do that, people are like, oh my God, baby, that's insane. I'm like, no, it's not like a solid plan. I just mean like you know when you're born. I was born November 17, 1982, right? When are you going to die? And that's a tougher conversation. And I was like, well, but that's very important because when you expire— determines the rest of your life, how long you're going to see your kids, like whether you could climb Mount Everest or not. You know, there's not a lot of 80-year-olds climbing Mount Everest, so maybe you should do it when you're 30. And so to me, it was very important that I know the end. Mm-hmm. And so I picked a date and I said, okay, like based on the stats, this is roughly the date I'm going to, And that's why I made this book, because whenever I would tell people this concept, they'd always be like, I have to know more. And I remember thinking, I was just like, oh, that's there's something there. That's a thing I have that's a unique perspective.
Yeah.
That should be written down. And so I wrote it. It was pretty simple. It was just my thoughts on it. And that was my Susie book. That was my, like, at some point, I think this might help someone at some point. But it's never going to be, like, the biggest seller in the world.
Which one sold more?
That one. Yeah. By far.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So. But that
one means something to you.
That one means something to me, yeah. So they both mean something, but that one's like a different level of like meaning. Yeah. So.
That's cool.
Cool, Matt. Dude, this is super fun. Thanks for bringing in all the books. I bet it's going to help a lot of people. So where can people find you?
Yeah. So a couple places. One, if you want a copy of my book, go to publishedbook.com/PDF. You can get the PDF, or publishedbook.com. You can get any format for free or just grab it on Amazon. This is the 10,000 foot view. This is what helps people. And then if you want to find my company, sellpublishing.com/apply, you can book a call with the team. We'll chat about your book, your goals for your book, all that stuff. And we're starting to do more stuff on social.
Notoriously so, only on Facebook, right?
Yeah. Facebook and LinkedIn.
I've tried to tag you on Twitter so many times and I'm like, wait, where are you?
I'm about to create an Instagram page. I feel like an old person. I'm thinking about trying it. But we're about to create an Instagram. I mean, it's just past time. We've got the sellpublishing.com Instagram, but I'm about to do a personal one.
I think you're onto something, man. There's way too many social platforms out there. And we post on all of them, but then I can't really engage on any of them. It's just like too much stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe going one is like the old school. Like, I don't know if that's old school or not, but maybe it's the new thing to just be like, I'm good at this one thing, I'm going to stick to it.
You're certainly putting all of your chips in one platform.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's smarter.
Yeah,
or not,
I guess that's kind of the downside.
But Facebook has been that for me for a while, but now it's just old people on Facebook pretty much, I guess.
Old people and us. It's kind of your demo too, right?
Yeah, touche.
You know, when people like are just like, oh, it's a bunch of old people. I'm like, you know who's rich? Old people.
Yes.
You know who has
yes.
all the money on the entire planet? Mostly people that are 60 and over.
Yes.
So
great demographic.
Make fun of old people all you want. Richest demographic, most willing to spend their money. They got a big old nest egg that they're just like running out till they can.
Yeah.
I mean, old people have money.
Facebook's a great place to advertise for that reason.
Yeah. Awesome, man. This is great. Appreciate it, man.
Neville, you're the man. Appreciate you.
Yeah. Hey, it's Neville Madore here. You may see me from some of this content and wonder, what does this guy do? So my main thing we have is called copywritingcourse.com. All it is it's a simple video course that trains you how to become a great copywriter, write better emails, sales pages, promotions, email sequences, all those types of things. But also, it is part service, meaning we have this really advanced behind the scenes forum where you can upload your stuff and myself and other writers will go improve it. And the easiest way to improve stuff for us is just rewriting stuff. So let's say you have a cold email that you're reaching out to thousands of people with. You upload that, give us some background information, and we can go rewrite it in the way that we see people get better conversions every single time. So you're getting myself, professional writers, and the community giving you suggestions saying, hey, I think that's more confusing. What if you write it this way? A lot of times I prefer just rewriting the whole thing and sending it to you, maybe making a couple of images to put in there. And then the other thing we do is we have live weekly office hours. That means every week, a couple of people, just a small portion, come on to calls with me live, and we go through about 8 questions each time. Now, just remember, only about 1% or less of the community will ask a question on each office hours. So you will get time to chat directly with me. And I do these myself. So we'll talk to people for 5 to 20 minutes each, going over their stuff. And the cool thing is, let's say I make some recommendations, you can go make those changes and then come back the next week and be like, what do you think of these? And then we can modify it more and more and more until you get it nice and tight and solid. So that's what the copywriting course is. It's self-paced training. It's live forum, live office hours. And what our goal is whatever you spend on us within that same year, you get 10x or more back. So if you spend a certain amount of money, my goal is always that my training and help will make you 10x more back. Now, I can't always prove and guarantee that, but at the same time, this happens with so many people that it's always my goal with customers. So go to copywritingcourse.com and join. And I hope you're pleasantly surprised with our service. People say it's the best course community that they've ever joined in their entire lives. So I hope you have the same results, and I'll see you inside. Take care.